Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, appeal to help Samoan farms affected by Cyclone Evan. New rules require Chinese children to visit their aging parents. And mass demonstration by anti-government protesters in Hong Kong. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parron. In December, tropical Cyclone Evan left a trail of destruction across the Pacific. Hardest hit were Samoa and Fiji, and both countries are trying to recover from the storm. In Samoa, especially hit hard were the farms, which supply food for the villagers, as well as a source of income for them in local markets and elsewhere. To help recover over the past few days, the Australian-based Organic Matters Foundation has been running an appeal to raise $10,000 to assist. Cambo Clooney speaks next to Mike Smith from Organic Matters Foundation.
Sure. Organic Matters Foundation, it's a very small foundation, and we started it several years ago to train farmers in sustainable agricultural practices. So we have a training program called Soil School, and we've been travelling all around the Pacific Islands for several years now, delivering that training program very successfully. And it's not necessarily organic, and it's not necessarily conventional. It's just somewhere in between, teaching farmers about their soil and that it's just a little bit more than to hold the plant up, and understanding microbiology and at the farmer level. So it's really gets that information to them.
All right. When we talk about Samoa and other Pacific Island nations, are we talking mainly about the village farms, the village plantations, which supply food for these places, or are we talking about for a market?
Agriculture itself, right at the grassroots level with the village farmers, their crops, their plantations. They've copped a bit of a hammering through Cyclone Evan, so we thought that it was a good idea to try and help them from an agricultural perspective, get those seedlings going, get them back in the ground, and build that food resilience again.
All right, then we'll have a talk about how the appeal went for a start, but let's talk about the scale of the problem. We've spoken with a few people, particularly in Samoa, and because they feel that, that there was, a lot of these farms, of course, on hills, they've had some pretty significant problems, and they've had a pretty serious effect. What are you hearing about what's happened over there as far after Evan?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's been some, got pretty smashed up, and we didn't hear a lot about it in Australia in the media from that perspective. There's a lot of things like greenhouses that were supplying seedlings and tomatoes and things like that on a commercial basis that just completely got wiped out. Plantations of papaya and banana have just simply disappeared. So it's back into a replanting phase. And one of the biggest problems with taro plantations and things like that is that a lot of the emphasis has been placed on imported food, in recent times. Mm. And a lot of the food doesn't get planted anymore. So the resilience is not there. So what we've been trying to do over the years is build that resilience back in so that we can grow enough food. So if we do have natural events like this, we can, mitigate their effect somewhat. So we're in a replanting phase at the moment. The money that we've raised through the generosity of Australian people and people around the world, actually, will go to a lot of that replanting of vegetable crops and bananas and papaya and plantations and things like that.
You mentioned there that you were trying to raise $10,000 Australian for the appeal. I think the appeal has come to a finish. How did you go?
Went fairly well. We're fairly ambitious in our $10,000 mark, considering it was right before Christmas, and people do have other things on their mind, but their generosity was fantastic. We managed, right up to Christmas Eve, we managed to raise $3,500 Australian dollars, which is exceptional given we only ran it for 5 days. We're still, open to, donations if people are still keen. However, we're just getting it all together now and starting to distribute it. So 3,500 is a pretty good result for 5 days. Thank you to social media. It kind of works quite well.
It's becoming the way things are done, aren't they? Look,
yeah.
Just before I'll get you, if you're happy to let people know where, if they want to take part in it or help, how they can get in touch with the foundation through that social media and elsewhere.
Sure, yeah. The Organic Matters Foundation has a Facebook page, which is where most of the day-to-day happenings are. We're also on the website where you can hit a donate button. The website is all the W's, organicmatters.org.au.
All right. And, of course, you're doing this in Samoa, looking to other places around the Pacific. Fiji was hit in some of their farming areas as well and food farms there. Is that something you're considering?
Absolutely. I'm heading off to Fiji next week to have a look and see what can be done there as well.
That was Mike Smith, the principal of the Organic Matters Foundation, speaking with Campbell Cooney. China has passed a new law that means adult children who don't visit their elderly parents on a regular basis will face legal action. The law does not specify the frequency of such visit, but it does reflect the government's latest efforts to grapple with social issues driven by its drive towards development. We have this story from Kendaha Sepati.
The rapid pace of development in China comes at a cost to its traditional extended family and values like filial piety. Increasingly, there are reports of elderly Chinese being abandoned or neglected by their offsprings. An eighth of the Chinese population is over the age of 60, and more than half of them live alone while their children leave home to work in the major industrial cities. Last year, for the first time, population distribution between the rural and urban areas was split equally, 50-50, and this is expected to tilt towards urban growth in the years to come. Professor Carrie Brown, director of the China Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, says the impact of the very mobile society goes beyond the breakup of family values.
I mean, you've got the same kind of issues of, you know, family breakup and family kind of being dispersed that you have in Western developed societies, and the same kind of problems of, you know, how do you create social cohesion in cities when you know, you've got kind of people coming in very, very rapidly. I think Shanghai has something like 12,000 new people arrive every week into the city. And so, you know, you've got massive issues of how do you build a kind of sense of identity and community with people who are from elsewhere and have only recently arrived. And this creates all sorts of, you know, social issues that are probably much more difficult than just the sort of family issues. I mean, issues of crime and cohesion and the rest of it. So, you know, this is a very, very mobile society going through massive changes very, very rapidly.
Many youngsters move miles away from home to the big cities for better opportunities, but often find themselves trapped in a system where it is difficult or expensive to visit their parents regularly. Although China has moved to strengthen labour rights over the last few years by way of better wages and holiday rights, Professor Brown says there is still a fundamental flaw in China's labour policies.
At the end of the day, Chinese economic growth is still, a large amount of it is still built on an export-orientated model, and a lot of that is built upon low labour costs, although, as I say, I mean, that's changing a little bit. And labour costs have risen in the last, you know, sort of couple of years in China. But you don't have huge protections for labour. You have problems of unionisation. Only one government union is recognised. And this creates all sorts of issues for people protecting their rights. And so in a sense, well, probably people wouldn't easily want to go back to their hometowns while they can have opportunities to earn and, you know, even over a holiday period.
Often it's during the new year that millions of Chinese return home to their villages, putting such a strain on China's transport system that many opt not even to do this annual trip.
Over Chinese New Year, the Chinese train and plane and road system is absolutely a kind of stretching point, really difficult to get around. Often there's bad weather too, as it was a couple of years ago, causing huge problems. And so many people probably think, wow, this is a big, big, you know, kind of challenge getting back. I'll just leave it. And having a law in place saying you have to go back only kind of adds to the kind of burden on the infrastructure and the logistics.
China's one-child policy and the dramatic advance in life expectancy have increased the burden of care on those from a single-child home. Children from such homes face what is known as the 4-2-1 phenomenon, where on reaching working age, he or she could have to care for two parents and four grandparents in retirement. By 2050, more than a quarter of the population will be over 65 years of age. And Professor Brown says China needs to spend a phenomenal amount of money to address this issue.
How do you create the social welfare and the infrastructure to be able to look after, you know, an increasingly elderly population and one which is living longer and longer? I mean, the average life expectancy in China has increased over the last decade even, so that women live into, I think the average age is 82 and men it's 80. And so there's over 30 years where they're basically reliant on pensions and on being looked after by families. But of course, the family structure breaking down and there being a big sort of, lesser younger people now is a massive problem. It's something the government is trying to do, you know, sort of by building a kind of social welfare system. But this is going to be an enormous challenge and a massive investment over the next few years. And it's very hard to see how it can be properly funded.
There's no quick redress to the problem that China faces. Even if the one-child policy is lifted, its impact could only be felt many years down the track. And as Professor Brown explains, even that would have severe consequences of its own.
The problem of having such a huge population and the issues of how to feed that population, how to meet its expectations in terms of education, in terms of what society provides people, what the government provides people, these issues don't go away. And, you know, having more people doesn't help them. The fundamental thing that China needs is obviously, like in Western societies, to deal with a very different family structure, deal with a more urbanized population, deal with how do you create social welfare, deal with social cohesion, very similar problems to developed countries now. And that is obviously, you know, the only difference is this is something that's very new for China, whereas it's something that developed countries have been dealing with for quite a while.
On January 1st, it was a day for a tit-for-tat political demonstrations that took place in Hong Kong, where tens of thousands of people turned out demanding the resignation of the new chief executive, Leung Chee-ying. Mr. Leung has had a rough ride since taking office last July, culminating in a no-confidence vote last month that he barely survived. His ratings have never been strong, but they've plummeted even further in recent weeks over allegations that he renovated his luxurious home without official permission. That anger is being channeled by anti-government activists who want universal voting rights to choose who runs Hong Kong. Corona Porriger speaks to Willie Lam, who's a political scientist from the Chinese University of Hong Kong.
At this stage, the CYLM government is seen as being too servile to Beijing. CYLM is being seen as a stooge of Beijing. And recently, he has aroused popular anger by appointing several pro-Beijing politicians to senior positions in the Hong Kong government. So this is the root cause of the problem. Even though Beijing has in theory promised Hong Kong universal suffrage elections in 2017, people are very skeptical about Beijing's promises.
There were attempts to have a pro-government rally facing off against the anti-government demonstration today. How did it turn out?
The pro-government demonstration earlier this morning was much smaller than the anti-CYLM protests, which is still going on. At this stage, the organizers and the police have not released the numbers, but it looks like the anti-government demonstration has attracted several tens of thousands of demonstrators. So this is, I think, a strong voice for change in Hong Kong and a strong voice to put pressure on Beijing to quicken the pace of democracy in Hong Kong.
Mr. Chun Ming took office just 6 months ago in July. What's happened to his popularity since then?
Well, actually, CYLM did not have any honeymoon. Since he took office on July 1st, his popularity rating has been below 50%. I think the main reason is that he's seen as a yes man, as somebody who will unhesitatingly carry out Beijing's orders, but not necessarily representing the voice of Hong Kong people. So even though his term of office runs for 5 years from July 1st this year, it's unlikely that he will enjoy popular support.
How will today's protests be viewed in Beijing? Will they undermine the support for Mr. Chunying?
At this stage, Beijing is having doubts about Mr. Leung's ability to govern. However, because this is just the first year of his administration, there is no possibility that Beijing will back down and appoint another person. I think the prevailing theory in Beijing is that of a conspiracy theory, namely that so-called hostile anti-Chinese forces from abroad are trying to stir up trouble in Hong Kong to embarrass Beijing. So at this stage, I think most of the senior officials in Beijing are still supporting Xi Wai Leung, at least in public. But privately, I think they are quite anxious about Xi Wai Leung's ability to maintain stability in Hong Kong in the rest of his 4.5 years term.
Now, we've had several days of pro and anti-government demonstrations and rhetoric in Hong Kong now. What will be the fallout from today's protests?
Well, in the foreseeable future, in the coming year, in 2013, I think it will be very difficult, I think, for the Leung administration to orchestrate support for its policies. There will be a lot of gridlock in the administration. It will be difficult for Xi Wai Leung to carry out policies. However, in view of Beijing's support for CY, I think this climate of a stalemate will continue.
In the past couple of years, we've seen some very strong increases in control in China, on the mainland, over social media, but also the arrests of many people involved in the 2011 so-called Jasmine Revolution demonstrations. How's this protest likely to be seen in Beijing, given the current climate?
Well, for the past several years, Beijing has been very nervous about the voice of democracy influencing the pro-democracy movement within China itself, because information travels very fast and it has been very difficult for Beijing to prevent information from Hong Kong from spreading to the mainland. It's quite likely that the Xi Jinping administration in Beijing will redouble efforts to control the internet so that the pro-democracy people in China will not take inspiration from Hong Kong.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us on any of the stories, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. India's Deputy High Commissioner to Australia says his country is a safe place to travel for foreign women, despite protests over social attitudes and legal protection for females in India. The gang rape and substantial death of a young woman on a bus in New Delhi has focused attention on the level of sexual assault in India. Melissa Clark speaks to India's Deputy High Commissioner for Australia, Surinder Datta.
It is very unfortunate that this thing has happened, but the government on its part is taking all its efforts to see that such type of incidents do not happen in future.
But many of the women in particular who are protesting say it's more than policy change that needs to happen, that there needs to be a cultural change from Indian men in the way they treat women. Do you think there needs to be improvements in the way Indian men treat Indian women?
In fact, for that, keeping that also aspect in view, the government has already immediately announced a committee headed by former Chief Justice of India, and which has its members, one of our ex-Solicitor General and other ex-Chief Justice, they are asking, they have told the people to send their comments within a week's time. And the committee headed by the Chief Justice has been given 1 month time to submit its report, which will look into all the aspects, including the current provisions of law and the changes which are required for the treatment of the woman and their safety, security and respect for the woman.
Are women safe on India's streets if tourists are coming, if Australian tourists are coming to India? Should Australian women feel safe travelling in India, given the gravity of this crime that we've seen?
No, they are totally safe. In fact, this is only one incident. Otherwise, in India, the protests have been going on, but they are peaceful protests. No institution has been attacked, no individual has been attacked, and there is no cause of concern. Everything is quite normal. Business is as usual, and no danger to the foreign tourists coming to India.
That's from the protests, but what about from others who may perpetrate similar crimes? We have had Indian women tell us that women there, be they foreigners visiting or Indian women themselves, face regular assaults from men. Is it safe for women on the streets?
No, they are totally safe. You see, within immediately after happening of this unfortunate event, our top leadership has assured that all remedial measures will be taken, and there will not be any. They will see to it that such type of incidents do not occur. In fact, they have just created. Government has just created a 24-hour helpline. Its number is 181, and it will be connected to all the 185 police stations in Delhi region. So there is no cause of any concern. The tourists in India are welcome as usual, and there is no danger to them.
Now, some of the protesters have been calling for the judicial processes to be sped up when it comes to these sorts of cases. Is that something the Indian government is looking at doing?
Yes. As I mentioned just now, the committee, which is headed by the former Chief Justice of India, has been tasked to give its report within 1 month. And they will suggest ways and means in the procedural cases, procedural matters also, so that there could be even immediate creation of fast-track courts. Trials will be conducted in such cases on day-to-day basis.
Charity and health workers are increasingly under attack in Pakistan. Earlier this week, 6 aid workers and 1 doctor were gunned down in the northwestern Sawabi region. And last month, 9 people were killed while delivering polio vaccines across Pakistan. The Pakistani Taliban is suspected to be behind the attacks. It claims the vaccinations are a plot to sterilize Muslims. We have this report from Michael Edwards.
The attack was swift, brutal, and seemingly senseless. 6 aid workers and a doctor were shot dead when gunmen opened fire on their van in the Swabi district, about 75 kilometres northwest of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The husband of one of the women killed says his 3-year-old son was taken out of the van before the shooting started.
I called her half an hour before she had finished work. I told her that I would come and get her. Then I went to put petrol in my car. While I was at the petrol station, I received a phone call saying there had been a shooting on the vehicle. I rushed there to find them dead inside the vehicle. My child had been taken out of the vehicle before they shot the women.
The victims work for the NGO Support with Working Solutions. The organisation is involved with health education in underdeveloped parts of the country. It runs a school and helps with the vaccination of children against polio, a disease that can cripple or kill within hours of infection. In December, 9 people delivering polio vaccinations were killed in Pakistan. The Taliban is suspected to have carried out the killings. Ali Dayan Hassan is the head of Human Rights Watch in Pakistan.
These attacks are taking place essentially because the Taliban and their affiliates view NGOs as Western agents and seek to erode their influence and seek to prevent them from operating in areas which they perceive as their domain.
Disease is a constant problem for developing countries such as Pakistan. It's one of just 3 countries where polio is still endemic. The UN's Children's Agency, UNICEF, and the World Health Organization have suspended their anti-polio programs in Pakistan. Ali Dayan Hassan says the attacks have reversed many of the gains made in recent decades against polio.
Absolutely. Polio, in fact, had been eradicated in Pakistan, and it has made a comeback because the TTP, i.e. the Pakistani Taliban, insist that somehow polio vaccination is a Western conspiracy. They know perfectly well that it is nothing of the sort. It is just that health workers are easy targets.
There has been particular opposition to vaccination campaigns after a fake CIA hepatitis vaccination drive helped to locate Osama bin Laden in 2011. Ali Dayan Hassan says the Pakistani Taliban is responsible for war crimes against the public.
This includes the large-scale targeting of civilians going about their business, attacks on marketplaces where you will find 100 or more people have been killed in repeated attacks on health workers. It includes attacks on educational personnel. For example, in the education sector, last year we documented about 100 attacks on schools in largely concentrated in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province bordering Afghanistan and also in parts of Balochistan province.
The World Health Organization fears polio could spread beyond Pakistan and into other parts of South Asia and the Middle East.
And that was Michael Edwards reporting. And finally on the program, the 1st of January traditionally sparks a surge of good intentions, making a start of many New Year's resolutions. Around the globe, hope burns anew in those planning to kick smoking or losing weight. The resolve of others will face an even tougher test. For people suffering from addiction at Sydney's Odyssey House, failing to fight their dependency could mean the loss of family, friends, and even the difference between life and death. We have this story from Nancy Knotson.
Lockies can do requests and stuff as well. It's fine, all right.
Although the clock hasn't yet struck 12, for residents at Odyssey House, the countdown to a new start began a long time ago.
It's going to be a good night.
Yeah, I'm the DJ. Of course it's going to be a good night.
The rehabilitation centre's residents bustle about, organising New Year's Eve celebrations. But unlike many other parties tonight, there are no drugs or alcohol here.
I'm looking forward to celebrating 2012, which, you know, represents the most significant recovery I've had.
Chris P, as we'll call him, is a senior resident of Odyssey House, having begun treatment in February.
Before coming to Odyssey, the only way I could get through the days was using powerful opiates, OxyContin, morphine, pethidine. If I couldn't get my hands on those drugs, then I'd go to Redfern or King's Cross and score heroin. I was that depressed and that miserable that that's what it took for me to get through the day.
Addiction affects tens of thousands of Australians. Substance abusers can spend months in rehabilitation, trying to sort out their lives, gambling, alcohol and drug-free. But a few months of treatment are nothing compared to the years of torment former addicts like Chris M have faced.
When I was selling drugs, it meant that I'd really cross and change different drugs, but I wasn't really any good at it because I spent a lot of time in jail for it.
Chris M says he started using heroin at age 12, but has now finished his treatment at Odyssey House. He's even joined a gym.
Since being here, it's really, really helped me to grow as a person because I started using at 12. My maturity didn't really grow into anything great, so a lot of the time I'd be more like a child when things would go wrong. They've empowered me with my life back now and I've got my own choices and I realise it's all my own choices that cause whatever to happen.
What we stress as much as possible is to try to get people to deal with reality.
James Pitts is the head of Odyssey House.
One of the things that I talk about just before we break for Christmas is that it's great, certainly, that people are with us because they're safe. They're not facing the prospect of maybe a drug overdose, actually being involved in some kind of violent incident and things like that. But we also, I also promote the idea that don't be here next year. In other words, you know, it's great that you're here for the time being, but don't be here next year.
James Pitts says the holiday season around Christmas and New Year can be tough for residents away from family and friends. This New Year's party theme at Odyssey House is, "I can't believe you're wearing that." Chris M is already enrolled in a TAFE course and hopes to work with people.
Yeah, basically that's full time, and in between that I'll be going and visiting my father. He's pretty old. It's just good now to be able to support him without him having to have the worry of me using.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Once again, if you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. A special thank you to Radio Australia for the content used. Until next time, friends, Keith Powell here. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.